As many of you know, in the late 1800s, Helena Petrovna Blavatsky claimed that she was in touch with Eastern masters who had asked her to bring some of their philosophy and their understanding of humanity, the nature of humanity, and humanity's place in the world to the West. Although these individuals did not appear often in public, no less than 30 reputable people at the time of H.P. Blavatsky reported that they had seen and communicated with at least one of these men. And I will read some of those testimonies tonight. Now, people who did not see them, which was the vast majority, began to wonder about these characters. They were usually called the brothers, sometimes called adepts, sometimes mahatma, which means great soul, maha, great atma, soul. And they were called masters. But this was misunderstood to a large extent in a Christian culture because it seemed like our Lord and Master Jesus Christ. No, it was used in the term of a schoolmaster. So the headmaster of a school or the master of a class, you see. And the early theosophists around HPB, most of them, understood that. Now, I wrote the Masters of Wisdom partly to clear up some of these misunderstandings and let them talk to you in their own words from the letters. Among those who were so curious about these brothers at the time of HPB was one by the name of Alfred Percy Sinnett. He was a prominent Englishman in India. He was acquainted with H.P. Blavatsky and her colleague, Colonel Henry Steele Olcott. And when those two were in India, he invited them to his summer home because he was fascinated with the phenomena that HPB allegedly produced. So she and Olcott went to his home and spent some time with him there. And she produced, allegedly again, an enormous amount of spectacular phenomena. Now, Mr. Sinnett was not a gullible person. He had a scientific mind. He was not a scientist. He was editor of the Pioneer, a very well-known English language newspaper in India, which published for many years. I think it only recently went out of print. It stopped publishing maybe a few years ago. I don't know the exact dates. So that was his profession, but he wasn't going to be fooled. And when he saw that phenomena, he was convinced it was real. Now, you must remember, in the 19th century, the physicists believed that our universe consisted of little billiard ball atoms with hard stuff at the nucleus, right? Could not be split. That was the ground of being, period. They were so arrogant in their views. This is history, I'm not denigrating them. I always think of something funny and sometimes I shouldn't say it, so I'll hold back. they were so arrogant in their views that the head of the physics department at Harvard University discouraged his students from taking graduate work because there wasn't anything else to find out. Now, I must put a little aside in here. These Mahatmas who taught HPB taught her that the cornerstone of the occult sciences rests upon the elusive nature of matter and the infinite divisibility of the atom in the 19th century, in the 1880s, when they thought HPB was a silly old Russian woman with no education. Well, she didn't have much education. But she wasn't a silly old woman. She was brilliant. All right, so he was very curious, and he said to Blavatsky, I'd like to write a letter to one of these brothers. Do you think they'd answer me? She said, I don't know. Just write one and give it to me. I'll see if I can get one to answer you. Well, he did. He wrote the letter to an unknown brother. She took it, and he was so anxious to get a reply, he wrote a second letter before he got a reply to the first. He finally did get a reply, and that developed into a correspondence that gave us approximately 140 letters from mainly one of those two adepts that we often speak of. And those original letters are housed now in the British Library in London, and I have handled them personally myself. We know these men existed. They're not figments of HPB's imagination, because she was accused of writing those letters, and the British Museum, well, it was the library, it was the British Museum then, not the library, and then it got transferred to the library. They said, we'll take those letters that you're offering us to exhibit on three conditions. One, that you allow our handwriting experts to look at Blavatsky's writing and the writing of these letters and determine she did not write them. They did that. They said, we haven't a clue who wrote them, but we know she did not. The second thing was, it was of historical interest. The Theosophical Society was a big splash in the 1880s over there, and the second international president, Mrs. Besant, was closely allied with Mohandas Gandhi in an effort to free India from colonial rule. And in fact, Mrs. Besant became the first president of the Congress Party, the Home Rule Party, a British woman of Irish descent. Can you imagine that? So they were interested in it for a historical reason. And there was a third very strange reason, and I point this out in the book and have a photo of one of the letters to show you. Some of these letters, many of them were allegedly precipitated, that is, produced phenomenally. They would fall out of the air onto a desk. Well, it takes a lot to convince me. But that was what they supposedly did. Those letters, when you look at them, it looks as though the ink is embedded in the paper. It looks as though the ink and the paper were produced at the same time. And the British Museum authorities said, we never saw anything like this. We have no idea how it was done. It's a curiosity. And those letters that were allegedly precipitated, and you'll see the photo in the book, some of those letters were 10 pages in the printed book. So they all were written by hand. And each character is composed of tiny little dashes. So instead of an A like that, it's like a dot matrix printer. And they never talked about that. Like you and I will email to Sydney, Australia, or call them up, and we don't think anything of it today. Because it's common. And so they were talking about things they wanted their recipient to know, and they didn't bother saying anything about these little dashes. So it's a curiosity piece. We have only the letters that Sinnott received. You see, we don't have Sinnott's letters. And Sinnott was a veritable question mark. In fact, I think K.H. said to him once, when will you cease using question marks? Something like that. He got tired of all the questions. So, but you can usually infer what the question was by the answer, can't you? Most often. So clearly he wanted to know, what are you boys all like? Are you just like us? Are you just ordinary human beings? Or what makes you different, if anything, from us? K.H. responded to him, and I'm going to read in part what he had to say. First of all, he insisted upon the fact that he is a human being like you and me. Well, not totally like you and me, but nonetheless, with a physical body that does not live for 1,000 years. However, they apparently are able to live for maybe 500 or 600 years, something like that, because they know how to take care of themselves and they live in a non-polluting environment. I was just, some of you may know that Tim Boyd, our national president, his mother is here. Lovely woman. It seems like she's 50 years old. And she walks around, she's alert, everything, no problem. I said to Tim, how old is he? Oh, is she? He said, 97. I couldn't believe it. I feel like I'm 110, and she's 97, walking around like she's 50. And then you hear people dying at 114. So it's not too unreasonable to think that very brilliant individuals who totally understood how the body works and all the rest of it could live a long time. But they do not live forever. Now, he wrote to Sinnet and said that he was an adept or a Mahatma only when using his occult powers. Only when acting from the inner self, we'll say a little bit about that later, not the personality, not the me, something, a state of consciousness much more profound, much more universal. When acting from there, he was a Mahatma and an adept, but he wasn't doing that all the time. He said, just like an athlete isn't strengthening and lifting weights all the time, only when it's necessary, they used that power when necessary. Otherwise, they were ordinary mortals. I would say extraordinary, but nonetheless. And he says, when I sit at my meals, this is KH talking, or when I am dressing, reading, or otherwise occupied, I am not thinking even of those near to me. And one of his students, named Jwal Kul, he said, can easily break his nose to blood by running in the dark against a beam as he did the other night. And I remained placidly ignorant of the fact. And then he underlines the next sentence, I was not thinking of him. Implying if he had been thinking of him, he would have picked it up. Now, I'm sure even some of you, and certainly I, can sometimes tell you the exact thought in somebody else's head, if I'm connected to them, thinking of them. I can almost hear the words. So if an adept who's really proficient at this, if he's focused on you, whatever you're thinking is like he sees it on the screen, you know, it's right there. But he's not thinking of him, and so just like you and me, he didn't know what happened. One-pointed in consciousness, we can only be focused on one thing at a time. We can do many things at a time, but we can only focus on one thing at a time. Obvious example of this is when you're on the phone and somebody in the room starts talking to you. You can hear them both. You cannot really listen to both of them, and you finally say, excuse me, what is it you're saying? And you go back to the other person. One-pointed in consciousness. Okay, and then he goes on and he says, from the aforesaid, you may well infer that an adept is an ordinary mortal at all moments of his daily life, but those when the inner man is acting. KH, when writing, is not an adept. So in one sense, the Mahatma letters are not Mahatma letters. They're not letters from an adept. They're letters from KH and Maurya and a few others here and there. A non-adept, that is, when not functioning from that inner state, is fallible, can make mistakes. Therefore, KH may very easily commit mistakes. And he goes on to point out that there might be mistakes in punctuation, wrong terminology, etc., etc. The wrong punctuation might change the whole meaning of a sentence. Now, these adepts work in a brotherhood or a fraternity. Before I go on about that, the adept is neither male nor female. The inner self is asexual. It's neither male nor female. The inner self can take a female body or a male body. Most of the ones we know of took male bodies. We can speculate why. There is some evidence, I don't happen to have that evidence, but I've heard of it, where they sometimes took a female body. So that's important. But they work in a fraternity of other adepts, and they accept what the superior of the fraternity says, not because he's their boss, but because they know he knows more than they do. Because they don't know everything. They're not omniscient, they're not omnipotent, they're not gods. They have extraordinary powers, but they're not omnipotent. Extraordinary knowledge, but they're not omniscient. In fact, in one of the letters, KH said, omniscience is far from me. So this makes it clear that they are human beings. And in the brotherhood, they abide by the rules of the brotherhood simply because they respect their superior's knowledge. You might say that if you trust a doctor, you will respect his opinion about your physical health more than the carpenter you know. So they work in that way, and they work by consensus. They actually get the permission of the Brotherhood to do anything they want to do, other than just by the rules. They obey the rules, but if they want to do something, initiate some program or something, they go to the Brotherhood and say, "Do you agree that we should do this?" They get the permission of the Brotherhood. And they weren't too sure that the Theosophical movement, which, well, it wasn't then, they weren't sure that this idea that K.H. and Moria had, they're the two from whom we got all these letters and the two that we, HPB, knew most about. They weren't sure this experiment, and they called it an experiment, would work. They had grave doubts. And K.H. wrote, "My brother and I," meaning Moria and himself, "are the only among the Brotherhood who have at heart the dissemination to a limited extent of our doctrines. None of my fellow brothers, with the exception of Moria, will help me in this work. Not even our semi-European Greek brother, the Master Hilarion." There are European adepts. So with permission from the Brotherhood, they began the experiment, and some strict rules were applied. K.H. wrote, "It was stipulated, however, that the experiment should be made independently of our personal management, that there should be no abnormal interference by us." So they got a hold of HPB and Olcott, put them together and said, "This is what we want, the general idea. You do it." And in one letter they said, if we had done it, it would have worked a little better, but nonetheless, you do it, not us. It is forbidden for us to do it. And they wanted an organization dedicated to universal brotherhood. When HPB met Moria for the very first time physically in the flesh, it was in London in 1851, and he had a conversation with her. It's a little bit uncertain as to exactly where that occurred. You can read about it in the book. And what he basically said was, "We've chosen you as the best person we can find to bring our teaching to the West. You're by far not perfect. You've got lots of faults, and we'll happily tell you what they are. but you're the best we can find." Now, why did they choose HPB? Now, I am going to take an educated guess. First of all, they say anyone who is connected directly with them, not just somebody they speak with, but somebody who is magnetically in some way that we don't quite understand connected to them, so that everything that person does is registered in the adept. They're very cautious about that. They put people on probation for a long time before they can be relatively sure, but not absolutely certain, that they'll succeed. So they say that person has to be endowed with clairvoyant ability. Why? Because one of their cardinal rules is, we do not waste energy. So if they're living in Tibet and they want to get a hold of somebody here in Wheaton, Illinois, if one of their agents, they want to be able to send a thought and that person gets it like that. You and I might get a little fragment of it and it'll get all twisted up and they'll have to keep pounding our head with a sledgehammer. You see, they have to use all that energy. They didn't have to with HPB. She got it as if she was talking to him on the phone. So that was one reason. She was not a chela, by the way, a direct student of the adept. She was their direct agent. They said she was far too passionate to be an adept. She had a tumultuous emotional nature. But she was their direct agent, and they had nothing but great good things to say about her, except for her faults, which sometimes irritated them. That was the one thing. She had to be endowed with clairvoyant ability. The second thing is unselfish. None of her enemies can claim she was selfish. There's some examples in the book that are just touching, absolutely touching, of her unselfishness. She'd give you her last penny, never think twice of it. Nobody could accuse her of being selfish. Oh, they accused her of being a fraud and all sorts of other things, but never selfish. So that was one of the cardinal requirements to in the spiritual life, unselfishness. Then the third one, she was so dedicated to her teacher that she would do anything he asked, bitching and moaning about it sometimes. It's all master's fault, you know. Get annoyed, but she would do it. They could trust her to carry out their directives. Now, she could have quit any time. When they asked her, would you take on this job? They said, you're not going to get anything personal out of this. You won't get any money. You're going to be attacked by all sorts of people. Friends will turn on you. I mean, you're going to have a hard time. You're not very well physically, and you're not going to get any better either. So you get nothing, zilch. But if you're willing to help out, you may help relieve some of the misery of humanity. And she did it. And it all came true. She didn't have enough money to pay for her own funeral when she died. She was ill a lot. She suffered from Bright's disease. She finally died of influenza in 1891. And people turned on her, and because of her tumultuous emotional nature, she was so upset sometimes about the things that happened that the adept said, we couldn't use her for 2 weeks because she was an emotional wreck. So they wanted this organization founded, and it eventually became called the Theosophical Society. Now, encounters with adepts, the people, so many people claim they've met these masters. I'm going to give you some testimony from people at HPB's time. The first is with Colonel Olcott. I read this one here at the last time I spoke on this subject, but it is so touching and so powerful that I think it should be read again. Before I read it, Colonel Henry Steele Olcott was a colonel in the Civil War. He was a lawyer, an agriculturalist. He wrote a book on sorghum, a grain, which is, I believe, still used in some universities. He became a Buddhist, and he wrote a Buddhist catechism, which all the different sects could agree to. He designed a Buddhist flag. He was so highly respected in this country that he was one of three men appointed to investigate the assassination of President Lincoln. So he was a scientific-minded person, not a scientist again. He wouldn't let HPB fool him. And there's some fascinating things in the book about him trying to catch her out, and she got a little angry at him because he thought she might do a trick, you know, and he wasn't going to have it. So it's an amusing little story. So I'm going to read what he said, because he claimed when he and Blavatsky lived in New York in an apartment on 47th Street and 8th Avenue, the southwest corner. If you're ever in New York, look me up. I'll show you the lamasery. All my TS friends go over and see the lamasery. It probably won't be there much longer. I think they've sold the building. It's about a 4 or 5 story old building, and it's falling apart. And I think it's a one room rooming house or something now. You know, a flop house, as they used to call them. So it may not be there any longer. But she had the windows on 8th Avenue and 47th Street, second floor. What we call second floor, British call it first. And here's what he wrote. I was quietly reading, with all my attention centered on my book. Nothing in the evening's incidents had prepared me for seeing an adept in his astral body. I had not wished for it, tried to conjure it up in my fancy, nor in the least expected it. All at once, as I read, with my shoulder a little turned from the door, there came a gleam of something white in the right-hand corner of my right eye. I turned my head, dropped my book in astonishment, and saw towering above me in his great stature an Oriental clad in white garments and wearing a headcloth or turban of amber-striped fabric, hand-embroidered in yellow floss silk. Long raven hair hung from under his turban to the shoulders. His black beard, partly parted vertically on the chin in the Rajput fashion, was twisted up at the ends and carried over the ears. His eyes were alive with soul fire, eyes which were at once benign and piercing in glance, the eyes of a mentor and judge, but softened by the love of a father. who gazes on a son needing counsel and guidance. He was so grand a man, so imbued with the majesty of moral strength, so luminously spiritual, so evidently above average humanity, that I felt abashed in his presence and bowed my head and bent my knee as one does before a god or a god-like personage. A hand was lightly laid on my head. A sweet, though strong, voice bade me be seated. And when I raised my eyes, the presence was seated in the other chair beyond the table. He told me he had come at the crisis when I needed him, that my actions had brought me to this point, and it lay with me alone whether he and I should meet often in this life as co-workers for the good of humanity, that a great work was to be done for humanity, and I had the right to share in it if I wished, that a mysterious tie, not now to be explained to me, had drawn my colleague and myself together, a tie which could not be broken, however strained it might be at times. Suddenly the thought came into my mind, what if this be but a hallucination? There's the doubting Thomas, you see. What if HPB has cast a hypnotic glamour over me, as she did sometimes? I wish I had some tangible object to prove to me he has really been here, something I might handle after he's gone. Well, the adept was in rapport with him, so he knew what he thought. The master smiled kindly, as if reading my thought, untwisted the turban from his head, benignly saluted me in farewell, and was gone. His chair was empty. I was alone with my emotions, but not quite alone. For on the table lay the embroidered headcloth, a tangible, enduring proof that I had not been overlooked or psychically befooled, but had been face to face with one of the elder brothers of humanity, one of the masters of our dull pupil race. That turban is at the international headquarters at Adyar. Other people had encounters with adepts, they claimed, very reputable people. One comes from Madame Adar Mavalenkar in 1881. He said, I have at least seen about a half dozen brothers on various occasions in broad daylight, in open places, and have talked to them, not only when Madame Blavatsky was in Bombay, because that's where the society was at the time, in the very beginning, but even when she was far away and I here. I have also seen them when I was traveling. I was taken to the residences of some of them, and once when Colonel Alcott and Madame Blavatsky were with me. Further than that, I cannot say, and I shall not give any more information either about them or the places they reside in, for I am under a solemn oath of obligation of secrecy, and the subject is too sacred for me to be trifled with. I may, however, mention that I know Kuthumi Lal Singh, that was how he first signed letters, usually it was KH after that, personally. I know him personally and have seen and conversed with him when Madame Blavatsky was here and also when she was far away. See, HPB was accused of making all this up. That's why he says when she was away, this happened. And then in 1883, William T. Brown claimed he met the master in broad daylight, and that he was not a, quote, crafty arrangements of Muslim and bladder. Madame Coulomb, who was ejected from the Theosophical Society on ethical grounds, said she would get back at the society, and especially Blavatsky. So she claimed that all the letters were created by Blavatsky, and that the masters that were seen were actually like puppets that her husband would carry around at the night, you see. And so that's why this phrase was used. So Brown said, on the afternoon of the 19th of November, I saw the master in broad daylight and recognized him, and on the morning of the 20th, he came to my tent and said, here he saw, the master knew this guy had his doubts, you see, he would have an experience, and then afterward, was it real? See, he was one of those doubting people that doubted everything, you see. So K.H. said to him, "Now you see me before you in the flesh. Look and assure yourself that it is I." And he left a letter of instruction and a silk handkerchief. Later in life, Brown began to doubt it all. And however, in a letter, K.H. said to him, "If an Eastern, especially a Hindu, had even half a glimpse but once of what you had, he would have considered himself blessed his whole life. And you saw and recognized me twice. You knew it was I and no other. What more do you desire?" K.H. was a little annoyed with him, I guess. "What more do you desire?" All right, so I want to say a little bit about some of the things that the Adepts taught. One in particular, K.H. pointed out that their philosophy and their ideas and their knowledge was not easily communicated. He says, "The occult science is not one in which secrets can be communicated of a sudden by a written or even verbal communication. If so, all the brothers would have to do would be to publish a handbook of the art, which might be taught in schools as grammar. It is the common mistake of people that we willingly wrap ourselves and our powers in mystery." See, they would be accused, "Why do you keep all these things secret?" "So it's a common mistake," he said. "They think we wish to keep our knowledge to ourselves and of our own will refuse wantonly and deliberately to communicate it. The truth is that until the neophyte attains the condition necessary for that degree of illumination to which and for which he is entitled and fitted, most, if not all, the secrets are incommunicable. The receptivity must be equal to the desire to instruct. The illumination must come from within." If you think about it, when you get a flash of understanding about anything, it doesn't come from the outside, does it? It comes from within yourself. So the understanding has to flash from within. Reading a book, remembering everything you wrote, and repeating it, well, you know, a DVD would be a bit better, wouldn't it? Because you might miss a word. The DVD wouldn't. That's not learning. That's memory. And that's, memory is a very important faculty that we human beings have, and animals as well. I mean, we have to remember how to get home from here, you know. So memory is an important thing. But in spiritual literature, the words point. The words are not the truth. H.P.B. made that very clear. So he goes on, "Then no hocus-pocus of incantations or mummery of appliances, no metaphysical lectures or discussions, no self-imposed penance can give it. All these are but a means to an end. And all we can do is direct the use of such means as has been empirically found by the experience of ages to conduce to the required object." And he goes on saying that fasting, meditation, incense, all those sort of things have their place, but they're only an aid, more or less. Now, most people are very interested in life after death. When I did a course ages ago in New York called Foundations of the Ageless Wisdom, and now it's a videotape which you can get if you want, I had the life after death theories as part of another talk. Well, they were so interested in that, I made it a full evening. Oh, well, we all gonna die, right? So we're very interested. What happens to us after death? Well, everyone except an Irishman who was in a small parish near Dublin, and the priest was preaching about life after about death. And he said, "Every member of this parish is one day going to die and meet your maker, and you'd better live a good Catholic life because every member of this parish is one day to die." And up front, O'Malley was laughing and laughing. The priest stopped his sermon. He said, "O'Malley, what's wrong with you? This is a very serious matter. I've just said every member of this parish is one day to die, and you're laughing like a fool." He said, I know, but I'm not a member of the parish." Everybody else knows they're going to die. But in any case, I'm just going to read you some of the things they say about life after death. Remember, these letters were written in the 1880s. No man, K.H. wrote, no man dies insane or unconscious, as some physiologists assert. Even a madman or one in a fit of delirium tremors will have his instant of perfect lucidity at the moment of death, though unable to say so to those present. The man may often appear dead, yet from the last pulsation, from and between the last throbbing of his heart and the moment when the last spark of animal heat leaves the body, the brain thinks. And the ego, that is the inner self, lives over in those few brief seconds his whole life over again. And Blavatsky comments on it as well. She says, for one short instant, the personal becomes one with the individual, that is, the me becomes one with the inner self and all-knowing ego. But this instant is enough to show him the whole chain of causes that have been at work during his life. He sees and now understands himself as he is, unadorned by flattery or self-deception. He reads his life, remaining as a spectator, looking down into the arena he is quitting. He feels and knows the justice of all the suffering that has overtaken him. Isn't that wonderful? A wonderful hope. Now, both the primary and secondary literature agree on this, that shortly after death, the individual may appear to someone. There is a lot of testimony about this, even among atheists. Suddenly they see Uncle Harry for just a flash, and they find out the next day he died. So for a little bit, not too long after death, you can actually project yourself to someone else and they will perceive you. But very shortly after that, you slip into a state which has been called Devachan. Blavatsky, we'll talk about that in a second. Many people, especially fundamentalists, are afraid that they might go to hell. They're going to be punished for their sins. Some deserve to, don't they? But anyway, never you and me, but others. You're not punished for your sins. You don't reap your karma after death, she says, and the adepts agree. She says, crimes and sins committed on a plane of objectivity, that's the physical world, and in a world of matter cannot receive punishment in a world of pure subjectivity. When we believe, meaning theosophists, in no hell or paradise as localities, well, even the modern church has given that idea up. They see it as a state of consciousness. I mean the mainstream Christianity, not the Bible thumpers. We don't believe in any objective hellfires and worms that never die, nor in Jerusalem with streets paved with sapphires and diamonds. What we believe in is a post-mortem state or mental condition as we are in a vivid dream. So there are two stages of this post-mortem state called Devachan. The first stage is the rupa, or the form stage. You're still Ed, Mary, Jack, or Jane, whoever you are. You're still identified with your personality. And in that stage, you live out your ideals. If you wanted to be a great singer or a great healer, now you are. You can sing on the stage of the Metropolitan Opera, you know, and enjoy it. Nobody hears you, but you think they do. It's all in your mind, but it's as real as this is real now. So you live out your ideals. If you had very few, you don't spend long time there. Not much to do. What happens very shortly after death is there's what the adept calls a gestation period. He didn't explain that too thoroughly, but Dora Kunz, whom I knew well, and we're going to deal with her in a minute, if I don't overgo myself here, she said that the aura is reorganized after death. It's as though the inner part of the aura becomes the outer part of the aura, something like that. Now, I don't see auras, so I just took her word for this. And she said that's how she could tell whether someone was dead or out of the body during sleep. So one of the members, once their son was lost in the mountains or something, and they said, Dora, can you find him? She said, I cannot tell you where he is, but I can tell you whether he's dead or alive. It's because she could see him, and then she could tell by the way the aura looked whether it was a person who died or whether it was one who was just out of the body during sleep. Now, what happens is the so-called baser emotions are sloughed off, just like the body is discarded and begins to disintegrate. The baser emotional mental nature is also sloughed off, and it becomes what was called in the early literature a shell. And the adepts say that is what the mediums pick up. They don't pick up the real person, they pick up this shell. Now that shell has residual memories, so maybe they say, well, it must be Aunt Jane because that's what she would say. Yeah, but it was like a tape going on inside of her psyche and the medium picked it up. But Aunt Jane was off somewhere else, you see. So that, and then the other thing is, the little truth in the idea of transmigration is that if you can think of the emotional mental nature as also being composed of atoms, they're not atoms in the physical sense, but it's still substance of a sort, they're sloughed off. If a person has been very base, full of lust and anger and hate and all those atoms gravitate toward the body of an animal, but not the person. So the person isn't reincarnated as an animal, but the leftovers of that psyche might be, see? The human being doesn't go backward, they keep progressing. Now there's first stage of Devachan is that, and then there comes what's called a second death. That's not like a death in the physical body where there might be suffering and pain and fear and all sorts of things. It's like going to sleep. Can any of you tell when the exact moment you go to sleep? I don't think so. 1 minute you're awake, the next minute you're not, and you don't know when that happened. That's the second death. All of the energy of the personality, everything has been exhausted, and then it is gone. And the inner self then is awakened to some extent, and you live, Blavatsky says, in a state of spiritual bliss for a few thousand years. That is, if you had the aspiration to the good, the true, and the beautiful. If you didn't, it's a precious short time. It doesn't exist for you. Now, there are exceptions to every rule, right? And, by the way, just before I give the exceptions, allegedly we get a preview of the life to live just before we incarnate. Not in all the details, but the general purpose of that coming incarnation. And of course, that's why we cry. But anyway, there are exceptions to every rule. There are exceptions to this that the adept points out. First of all, I think this was Blavatsky, but I'm sure she got it from them. She said the convinced materialist, and we know at least two of these, who are wonderful people, good, kind, amusing, talented, brilliant, lovely people, convinced that after you die, there is no conscious survival, period. One, his wife died suddenly. The police came to the door and said, we're came about your wife. He said, my wife's upstairs. Well, a friend of hers was on the phone and the phone went dead, so they went upstairs, she was dead, heart attack. Horrible. Wouldn't that be an awful shock? Well, it was a shock to him, too. Not even a memorial service. Nothing. Gone. Period. She says, if you are that convinced that there is no survival of bodily death, you will sleep through to the next incarnation. You won't go through Devachan. You'll just be unconscious until you're born again. So you miss your reward. Also, suicides. Suicides, A.K.H. said, are not dead. They've just gotten rid of the body. And they're stuck, some people call it earthbound, until the time that they were meant to go. We all have a due date, apparently. That can be broken. There are accidents. I know the common view of karma is there can't be any accident. Everything is deserving. You get what you deserve. And if you die in a plane, it's because it's your karma. Well, that's not what the adepts think. they say there are accidents. Everything is karma. The fact that the plane comes down, maybe there was an explosion or an engine failed or something, that's karma, because karma means action, movement. It doesn't mean that you get, it's not tit for tat, as they say, you know. So that's another exception. Now we come to the path. We're going to spend time on each of the requirements for the spiritual life. Just to read a few, not only a clean life, but an open mind, a pure heart, and eager intellect. Not enough to just have an open mind. Seek the truth, even when it contradicts your opinions. Boy, wouldn't you like some of the political partisans to believe that? They want their opinions reinforced. They're not interested in the truth. And then the obstacles on the spiritual path, and KH says the greatest obstacles of all on the spiritual path are selfishness, pride, and egoism. Now, many people say, are the masters still living? We don't know whether they're in the same bodies or not. But since the adept is the inner self, yes, they're living in that sense. But maybe they've taken another incarnation, maybe not. But I know for myself, and I do not convince easily, that Dora Kunz, the past president of the TS in America here, knew these men, saw them, and was a student. And I need a lot of evidence. Dora was my friend for about 40 years. She lived in New York early on, and then here, and then out in Seattle, but she lived a long time in New York, and we were good friends. And we were very fond of one another. She gave a talk in Philadelphia in 1955 on the Masters in the Path. And she was a person who knew the literature well and highly recommended we read it, especially the Mahatma letters and especially the Voice of the Silence. But when she gave a talk, she always said, I am not speaking from the books. I am speaking from my own experience. And I knew her well enough to know that was a solid fact. And she would never say something that was not her personal experience. So she was a little bit like Blavatsky in the sense that she had a very difficult personality. They said they had to impair HPB in some way psychologically. We don't have time to go into that. In order for them to be in constant communication with her. They called her a psychological cripple because of what they had to do. She agreed to it. They didn't force her. So she was a psychological cripple and couldn't help some of her difficult personality traits. We don't have that excuse. Well, Dora was like that. She was like the little girl with a curl. When she was good, she was very, very good, and when she was bad, she was horrid. When she spoke of the masters, you felt you were in their presence. And when she was acting from her personality, you felt like smacking her. I loved her, and I didn't let her bother me, but some people were very bothered by her. So I think she was in communication with them partly because she describes their facial expressions. That is not in any literature, nowhere. You will not find that anywhere, in any book. Other pieces of evidence besides this personality, her clairvoyant ability, she was born clairvoyant. She was an extraordinarily gifted clairvoyant, founded therapeutic touch, because she could see the energy flowing. Also, it was reported that Rukmini Devi Arundale, the wife of the third international president, was one of the students of the adepts. I don't know whether she was or not. But in the lobby down here, and this I got hearsay, but I got it from someone I trust, they said when Dora was told Rukmini died, Dora went, oh, I'm the last one. Last one what? Student of the adept in that group. And then someone living in the building here, and this was years ago, and I have no idea who it was, but it was reported to me. They were walking by her room. She used to live in the building. Late at night, like 3 or 4 in the morning, and they heard Dora in the room by herself, because her husband had been dead for years, saying, I am trying, I am trying. And try was used over and over again in the Mahatma letters. We have one word for all aspirants, try. I am trying, I am trying. All right, I'm going to read a little bit from her talk, and we're going to have to close with that, I'm afraid. But she says, when you know the masters, you cannot help but be devoted to them, but they don't want us to worship them. And she goes on in saying that the Theosophical Society was not meant to be a church, even though the churches have their place and have an important role to play, helping people feel devotion and that sort of thing. She said we should have a feeling of being colleagues with the masters, engaged in a great work. There are thousands of members of the Theosophical Society, but there are very few theosophists. It is very easy to sign a piece of paper and say you want to join and you believe in brotherhood, but brotherhood is something you have to live, not talk about. Now, I'm going to skip over to her description of the Master Maurya. The Master Maurya was the master of HPB. If you read the Mahatma letters, you will get some sense of his personality. The adepts have personalities, not personal ego, but they have very distinct personalities. As you know, Maurya is an Indian. He's very tall, and he comes from a very princely family. I think that if you are in his presence, you have a sense that you are in the presence of someone who is every inch a king. That feeling is true because he gives a sense of absolute integrity. That may sound a strange word. What is meant by absolute integrity? All of us have masks. We think in terms of little things that are not true. If you're in the master's presence for the moment, all that gets wiped out. All the little things which are not really true, which are not part of what we see as ourselves, are wiped out. If you're in his presence, you meet a person who is so absolutely in the center of his being, who's so absolutely true that you yourself get the sense of being thrown back into the absolute center of yourself. You get a sense even of the greatness and integrity of yourself. That's the inner self. That is accessible. This is not a belief to me, the inner self. It's a living reality. And every human being can access that. Meditation is the primary method. In his presence, you could not think of something childish or mean. Of course, there is also a tremendous sense of strength, and a strength which enables you to carry something through. In the master's letters, you will see, notice that he is very economical with words. Maurya is like blunt. KH is flowery. If Maurya wants to tell you your fault, he'll basically say, now in my words, you're a twit. Whereas KH will say, I hope I will not hurt your feelings if I say. They'll both tell you the truth, but KH will be more gentle with it. There is also a complete economy in emotion in Maurya, in movement, and in everything, even in his looks. He has a tremendously noble face, but whatever he feels is not reflected in it. It is a steady face. The facial muscles change very little, because it is the face of a person who is completely at one with himself, and who is cast in a solid granite mold of unity, integrity, and strength. She says she thinks that's a brief personification of Maurya. Then she goes on and says, the Master KH is totally different in many respects. Their two personalities could not be more different. Yet, they have a sense of tremendous devotion to one another, as you will notice in their letters. There's some very touching comments about that devotion they have to one another. They have been colleagues for so many lives. It is really a beautiful thing to notice how they work together. She saw this, or she wouldn't have said that. To notice how they work together. The Master KH is tall, but not as tall as the Master Maurya. He's about 6'7", roughly, they said. And the Rajputs, I believe he's from that group, they tend to be tall. He has a very noble face, like Maurya. Whatever he feels, that's KH, shows. Pictures could never do him justice because his expression varies from moment to moment. He writes beautiful English in the Mahatma letters. He has a great feeling for the music and the arts. I think that what the Master K.H. conveys is a feeling of love. You might think that if you were in the presence, Master's presence, you would feel very small and shy. Perhaps in Moria's presence, you would feel that a little, but not the Master K.H. You would have a sense of expanding consciousness, just as you do with the Master Moria. But the Master K.H. has the great gift of making a person feel as though you had known him all your life. Don't you think that's a great gift of love? He is a person who is so much a personification of love that it draws from me, Dora, all the love I am capable of. And so it draws from any person who comes into contact him with a sense of outgoing love. Now I want to end with this idea of being in rapport with the adepts. They say very emphatically they will not help people with their personal problems. They are not like Christian saints who allegedly can be petitioned to help you. They only work with individuals who can help in some way in the great work for humanity as a whole. They say humanity as a whole has paramount hold on us. But you can be in rapport with them. I am convinced of this. If you try not to think of them personally, not to just get an image of their portrait or something, but try to be open and get rid of your preconceived ideas, just drop your own ideas and see if you can get a sense of their dedication to humanity, you can enter the stream of their influence. You will be touched by it. And you can help. They want colleagues. Why would they say that if they didn't think we could help? This may take a while, but it can be done, has been done by thousands. So, through meditation, through living the life required, you can eventually tread the path to adeptship. If you try. Thank you.
One of the questions I have is about the energy. They seem to be very conservative about and aware of all their energy. Mm-hmm. Do you think in their higher states they're consuming more energy, which is why they only use it sporadically?
In their higher state, they what?
They use more energy?
I don't know if that's true, but if you think about it, most of us fritter away an awful lot of energy. We make unnecessary physical movements. Mental and emotional movements drain us a lot, don't they? Everything is movement, isn't it? Mind, emotions, body. They just say it's one of their rules to not waste energy. Not leave the lights on in your house all day long when you're not there, you know? I'm constantly going around home turning lights out. My wife gets annoyed. I said, I don't care if you let them run all day if you're using them, but if you're going to be away from them for 3 hours, why not turn them off? Well, it's a little bit like that, but it's the energy that they use. So they say they won't waste energy, and they will not use phenomenal means until all ordinary means have been exhausted. In other words, they won't levitate to come up to the third floor if they can walk up to the third floor, because that would take more energy than walking up to the third floor. Now, I mean, that's what they say. I'm just reporting now what they say.
There's a question through the internet. The Mahatmas repeatedly stated that they were alive, not spirit entities. How did this admission evolve to the Mahatmas becoming ascended masters in other traditions?
Yes. Well, there are many alleged encounters with masters, aren't there? And one of the groups from whom that ascended master idea comes somehow turned Moria into El Moria Khan. Sort of sounds like a Hispanic Jew, doesn't he? I don't know where they got El Moria Khan. And they started to call him Ascended Masters. The masters are no more ascended than you or me. They're human beings. They didn't ascend anywhere. See? So why they started to call them ascended masters, I cannot tell. But some of those groups were, you know, I mean, what they talk about and the way they say that these masters are talking and what they're teaching sounds nothing like what they write in their letters. So I personally don't believe it. But everybody's free to believe what they want.
Is there any indication of the number of incarnations the Mahatmas experienced to obtain their level of spiritual evolution?
Well, I think that's a little difficult to answer because it depends on the progress we make. You see, it's a little bit like statistics. The average age of death might be 75 or something, but some people live to 114, and some people die at 2. The spiritual path, the progress on it depends entirely, 100%, on the individual's effort. Make a lot of effort, fewer lives. Make a little bit of effort, more lives. Probably. So I think there may be some estimate somewhere in the literature, but I would take them with a grain or a dose of salts.
You sort of indicated that these adepts are no longer around, but I mean, would that be because the society itself has taken over the role of educating people, or is it just that they aren't needed anymore, or what?
Well, I think they're still around myself. I do think they are. And as far as the Theosophical Society, as I said early on, it was up to us to run it, not them. And Dora Kunz, from whom I just read, she was asked once, are the masters still interested in the society? And she said, if we are doing what they want done, they are. If we're not, they're not. They're not going to waste time with us. If we're frittering away talking about channeled entities and whatever else we want to talk about, they have no interest whatsoever. So yes, I think they're around. And when I said about getting in rapport with them, that's real to me. It's very real. Not personally. I don't think they're thinking of me personally. See what I mean? But I think you can enter the stream of their influence and really feel the power and the strength and the peace and the integrity of that. And then you impress that as best you can on your personality so that you reflect it more in your everyday life, you see. Their main concern is humanity as a whole, and if we are working in any way to help with that, they say we are already lay chelas. By joining the Theosophical Society, Dora used to say you're a pinprick in the Mahatma's consciousness for just that moment when you join. They take a quick look, but they say force a master to take you on by doing good works in his name. You will force the master. They say it's not up to us personally who we take on. You have to live the life, the selfless, altruistic life. The true theosophist, whether they ever heard of theosophy or not, is an altruist. And those who are not altruists are not theosophists, whether they're president of the society or not.
I was wondering about Krishnamurti, if in your research you came across anything about him being in touch with the masters.
Yes, Dora Kunz, whom I trusted very much, in her work, her ordinary personality, her opinions were God knows what, you know, but in her work, she was very careful. She said that she thought, her husband, first of all, told me, and he never talked about psychic things. He was apparently in India when Krishnaji, before he broke from the star, the eastern star, thousands of people, and something overshadowed him, and people fell to their knees. He wasn't seen for like 2 weeks after that in public. And when I asked Dora about it, she said, something overshadowed him. And that's all she would say.
One more question. Do we know of any theosophists who claim to be in contact with the masters currently?
There probably are quite a few, but I would have grave doubts about it myself. Dora never claimed to be in touch with them, but I think she was. Blavatsky even said once that if you're on the path, if you're a chela and you talk about it, it's almost a sure sign that you're going to fall off the path. Because it's pride and egoism, isn't it? It's look at me, I'm in touch with a master. You don't have to say you're in touch with a master. Live the life. Live brotherhood. Don't talk about it. And what does that mean? See each human being as another human being. My wife lives the Theosophical life in her computer training work. She teaches applications development to major financial institutions. Right now she's working for UPS. That's hardly a financial institution, but that's where she's working right now. And she'll be dealing with Blue Cross soon, and then Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation, which is a financial institution. She meets everyone, the janitor, the CEO, in exactly the same way. So she has friends all over the community. She'll call somebody up and say, Jim, can you help me with that? Oh, anything for you, Mary. Because she treats him as a fellow human being, you see. You can see it in the eyes of another human being, can't you? You don't think of their status or anything. You just look into their eyes and you see something of that inner spark. That's living brotherhood, isn't it?